Welcome to the Working Dog Depot podcast with your hosts, Rich Harden and Howard Young.
All right. Well, Howard Young, how are you, sir?
I'm doing very well, buddy. How about you?
Not too bad. Beautiful day here in the great state of Kentucky.
It is here in North Carolina as well, but it usually is.
Yeah, well, you guys are spoiled. You know, last couple of weeks ago it was, you know, 20 degrees and now it's 75 degrees.
Absolutely. Which actually, we've gone back and forth with heat and air conditioning at least three times in the last month or so. So today is another one of those. It was nice and chilly this morning, but we'll need air conditioning by this evening just to be comfortable.
Same here. Getting humid already. Well, yesterday you went to some training with Den Mother. What was that about?
Yes. Evan Nolte was giving his med class at Central Piedmont Community College. And it was great seeing him. You know, he's a good guy. So we had a good time catching up. And I had like five teams there, and they were really excited. And I could tell they were really getting confident by the instruction they were giving. So he was giving. And he's always entertaining. You know, he's a good dude.
Well, awesome. Well,
speaking of entertaining,
I don't think we should wait any longer since we're getting a cue card off to the side about we're boring people already. So why don't you go ahead and introduce our two guests that seem to have some dynamic personalities.
I've been working on this for a little while, so it's kind of like herding cats. We have Michelle Mon and Jenna Gadberry, who I just have to tell a little quick story. I attended one of their workshops last year, and I was sitting there and I was handed a beer, and Mitchell Christian slid in beside me. And I don't know if folks know Mitchell. Shout out to Mitchell Christian from Christian Canine Academy. He's always entertaining. Cameron Ford sitting in front of me, and I've just been handed a beer, and I thought, this is really shaping up to be something special. So it was. So I wanted to have these ladies on before the Hold the Line conference because it's coming up quick.
Yes, it is.
They will be there. And I already know the title to this. It's going to be called Revenge of the Nerds. I mean, I stole that from them. So it's a great title for our episode number 16.
Uh-oh.
So ladies, can you introduce yourselves, please?
All right. I'm Michelle Mon. Thank you for the introduction and adorable story about how amazing our instruction was at the last Hold the Line conference. I am a research scientist contracted to the U.S. Army out of Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland. And in that role, I study canine olfaction and sort of under the general umbrella of what we call olfactory sciences. And really, that's all about trying to enhance military working dog teams and give them the tools they need to be successful in the field. Over.
Ditto.
Wait, you could start, you know, about, you know, from your black site, if you could just use your name, that'd be great.
My name is Redacted. And Michelle nailed it. Jenna Gadberry, contract scientist at DEPCOM CBC. And as she stated, we work in the olfactory sciences group. So what that means is looking at how we can detect threats via odor. And our bread and butter is we dump millions, billions, trillions of dollars into all these fancy schmancy handhelds. And we come in and say, hold my beer. I have a better sensor that can find it at a far lower level than any of your technology out there. And so we're always happy to share our pluses and minuses, if you will, the successes and also the lessons that we learned, because there's a lot of crap that we do wrong. Let's face it. So happy to be speaking with you two, and also happy to be attending Blue Line Conference. What's up, Joe? My favorite baby Bjorn.
Oh my gosh. So I came across a gentleman last summer when I was in central Indiana and Indianapolis that has done some work with you all as well. It was kind of funny. He was sitting in the back of my class, and there were some other older gentlemen, and I put myself in that category, and they were just kind of sitting back, listening and not having much reaction. And I finally got an opportunity to speak with him, and I think he took my picture and he sent it to one of y'all, or I took. Yeah. Crazy.
We won't talk about that picture. That was a really awkward picture. Ho-yo.
I have a lot of awkward pictures. I mean, who doesn't?
You're talking about Craigie. He's one of our favorites.
Who?
Craig Patton.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely.
He's going to be so upset you called him older gentleman.
Well, I'm sorry.
He does golf, though.
He's a young golf snapper.
Yeah, he likes to whack those balls.
Yeah, we've worked with Craig for quite a while, and one of the nice things about our projects is that we know we're not the experts, and we know what we're good at, and so we'll bring people together, we'll hunt for funding, we'll, you know, work on experimental design, but we're not canine SMEs, and so, because that's not sort of our background, and so we'll bring in canine SMEs that can score the change of behaviors of the dogs and sort of confer with each other so that we're getting data set from the lens or from the perspective of people that have a very strong background in canine. And then we take care of the data analysis, and together that makes for much stronger projects and results.
So essentially there have been great efforts to try to develop a mechanical thing that will outperform our dogs. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think, you know, Jen and I have been reading articles for the past at least 10 years about hang up your leashes. We're not going to need the dogs anymore. There's this newfangled detection instrument that's portable and can do all the same things that the dog does. And then sometimes portable means that it's literally just not cemented to the ground. It's, you know, a couple thousand pounds. You can bring it on a flatbed truck, and that's how they'll define portable. Sometimes they'll say, you know, it can detect explosives far better than the dogs can. And then we put it to the test. Part of the work that our center does is third-party independent evaluations. So it acts as that sort of government babysitter in a very unregulated pool of canine. And we will put things to the test. And oftentimes these instruments do not live up to the manufacturer's claims. And it's neither here nor there for that company, because those instruments were tested under ideal conditions, but those aren't the conditions that we work under in theater, right? Or in operations. So we have to test them under, you know, ideal conditions, and then also the conditions that these instruments are going to be fielded in. And so, you know, maybe that instrument, that handheld, works very well indoors in a room, et cetera. But then when we take it out to the field, there's just too many confounding factors. So the dogs are really, really good at blocking out all of those. Jenna,
she's found the reaction button.
Who let Jenna have any control over the reaction button? Christ. Okay. So this is my ADD. I can't focus when Jenna's doing this.
She also won't look at me in meetings either.
We're not allowed to look at it. We're not allowed to sit next to each other.
They physically put us on opposite ends of the room.
I can see that already. Yes.
Yeah. Why that would happen? Well, Jenna, we'll have to tell them about the Schmarpa meeting.
Or when we redacted our entire briefing. And they made our boss sit in between us.
Oh, that's okay. I'm gonna write this down, because Ho-Yo wanted us to tell stories. And I was trying to think of what would be an appropriate PG-13 story to...
I know, because you sound really boring talking about your job.
I know.
I was like, there's no snooze button on here. Well, I raised my hand, though.
I wanted to back up just a second, though. So you guys, you know, you're research scientists, but how did you go down the road and end up where you are? Is this something that attracted you to that field? Is that something you thought about early on?
Are there people lining up for your jobs?
Right.
So how did you
end up where you are, I guess, is the question.
So maybe you want to hear the origin story of how Jenna and I became work wives.
Yes, sure. That'd be great.
Look at Ho-Yo's face. Did you see that? That was like, I don't know if it was disgust or if he had like acid reflux. It was really weird.
It was a microfacial expression.
Oh, wow.
AI ML, what do you think it would have said?
It would have said his pants. I think it said it would Boner Town, because he's like, oh, we're going to hear about
America Boner.
Women on women in the workplace.
We've all seen that movie.
I'll be the pizza delivery girl.
Highly frowned upon at our place of work, by the way.
Yes.
Without mop gear.
All right. So, Jenna, you want to talk about your background? We'll talk a little bit about our backgrounds.
Yeah. Where you started in this and how you ended up where you are.
All right, Jenna, yours is the really good one.
I know, but yours is kind of boring, so you go first.
Okay, I'll get mine over with quickly then, since it's so boring. I had intended to go to veterinary school since I was, 3 years old, just like every little girl that dreams of becoming a veterinarian. And in the course of all of the academics that are required to go to vet school, I sort of decided that that wasn't the path for me anymore. And then I was really more interested in the research and development side of animal health, animal science. Oh my God, now she's sending me GIFs on my phone.
Just turn her off.
Oh my gosh. So immature. All right, turn that off. And so I fell in love with the research side. And then my first postdoc, you finish your PhD, you got to do a postdoctoral fellowship, was at the Army at Aberdeen Proving Ground, where I work now. And there was a canine project that they needed help with. They said, hey, any of you nerds not scared of dogs? And I raised my hand because I had plenty of experience, at least I thought, with dogs. And that was really small animals that I was used to in the, pets in the veterinary practice, not military working dogs that try to eat you. So I guess I was somewhat foolish in raising my hand and volunteering for that first project. But we did the project. It was a huge success. And that was sort of the beginning of olfactory sciences at where we work. And so now we've sort of built that into a much bigger program. So Jenna, you tell your story.
Mine starts off pretty boring too. Went to UC Davis for biological sciences because I, just like every little girl, wanted to work with dead people and be a forensic scientist. So went through my 4 years there, loved it, thought forensics was going to be my final landing place, moved to DC and worked in a Department of Defense laboratory as a forensic scientist in the DNA lab, so I am a DNA geek, and moved on from there to working on vaccines with adenovector, so adenovirus vaccines for malaria for the Department of Defense, and received an email for my resume on Monster, which I didn't even... Is Monster still around?
Yes.
It is? Oh, okay, sweet. That said, hey, do you want to do forensics, but you're not going to be in the lab anymore? And that was intriguing enough. So very long story short, I wound up working at another agency in the forensics subgroup, and I managed projects for battlefield forensics. And this was the height of OEF, OIF. So battlefield forensics was kind of a new thing for us, and being able to determine individuals, identifying them from, fine pink mist or goop that you could find. So that was very interesting, in being able to figure out how we could take things from the lab and put it into the hands of our service members to help us pull things back into the lab. And during this, I also worked on human scent identification, and as such, got to work with some amazing individuals at Florida International University, a couple of other agencies, and as we could all assume, IEDs were a pretty big thing. So we are looking at how we can identify individuals that may have been working on, around, or with these IEDs that were being placed. Also, where did they run off to? Could we find them? Could we track them down? From there, I moved into more of an operational canine realm, because that is when Green Berets Special Forces came forward and said, we do not have a canine program, and we need to ramp one up quickly because we are now in a hand-to-hand war. So in case any of our listeners are in the dark on that, fun fact, we were told by all of our analysts, military analysts, that we are going to be moving to a digital war and no longer needed any of those hand-to-hand combat capabilities. So we got rid of the majority of our military working dog programs, and the very first one was the Special Forces program. So my next other duties as assigned was, the director said, Jenna, make it happen. We need a multi-purpose canine program. So at a ripe age of 21, I was running around the nation trying to figure out what was a multi-purpose canine and where should the schoolhouse be and what did the program need to look like and how to deploy a dog. So to say the very least, I became a sponge and learned from some really knowledgeable, awesome people what to do and also what not to do in developing a program, and remember deploying the very first dog overseas and making sure we had vet support and all of the other logistical nightmare that comes in to play with deploying an animal, whether it be Conus or O'Conus. And from that one dog, now they are upwards of 200 animals in the SOF MPC program. So from there, needed to figure out, all right, I've got this dog deployed. Now, how do I make sure he has all the right equipment, all the right explosives? So we kind of forget, especially within the DOD, I mean, we haven't assessed our explosives kit since 1972. Fun fact, the threat has changed explosively since 1972, but we're very reactive. And we look at our programs and say, well, if it ain't broke, like, why would we bother touching it? And I think that's where Michelle and I really excel in pushing that envelope and trying to put a little bit of science behind why do we do what we do? And we ask handlers, why did you clear that car the way that you did? And more times than not, because I was told to do it this way. But why? Why were you told to do that? Or why are you deploying your dog into those woods the way that you are? Well, my grandpa told me that's how I need to do it. So we have a lot of this intrinsic knowledge, but it's coming from, sorry guys, the old guys in the business who don't necessarily have a sound reasoning. So a lot of what Michelle and I are doing now is trying to either justify why we do things the way we do with science or enhance what we're doing, because we are very, very reactive as a country. And I mean, I don't have to tell you both, but I mean, there's a lot of countries that have some pretty banging dog programs. And the reason why they do is because they lash up with their scientists and they lash up with academia and industry. And there is a very close cohort and we just don't have that. And I think that we're starting to see a little bit of a turn where the old timers and maybe even the new timers are willing to listen to these scientists, but it's also on the scientists too, because we don't speak the same language. And if I tell you all these crazy scientific things and, you know, fluid dynamics, let me talk to you about odor and this, that, and the other, you're going to tune out. But if I give it to you in the right terminology, you're going to understand and you're going to engage with me. And the flip goes with me. I have to understand all the terminology that you're using. Michelle and I are up against this right now in developing a paper that identifies all these terms and definitions because they differ between the scientific community and the canine community.
For sure.
And
absolutely.
It's a struggle, but honestly, it's a fun struggle because we get to deal with people like you guys and you get to see us nerd out and hand you beers in our briefings. But it's identifying where that commonplace is, where we can come together. You know, Michelle and I say, dicks on table, like, let's just get it out of the way. Ego and agenda, we don't like to have it. And let's have these open conversations and have involvement and buy-in from all different sides, end users, stakeholders, everyone has to be invested. Otherwise, we just have scientists running off in one direction and making canine people do what really maybe they didn't need to do. So there's my really long story about where I am and where I came from. So,
well, that's pretty cool. I like you talked about trying to stand up a program that, you know, overnight, basically, for you know, spec ops that actually needed something because they got rid of it. Do you see that trend now getting rid of programs now that we've drawn down? And, you know, I know that some programs, I won't mention any names, that have already started to get rid of dogs.
I think we're going to continue to see that just due to, like you said, we've got conflicts coming and going. But fun fact, we're the most hated country in the world. So
that's true.
I think that there's always going to be those growth patterns, and it's going to be that attrition where it's like, you know what, maybe we got rid of too much and then we're going to see it ramp back up. But hopefully when we ramp things back up, especially the program that you're referring to, we can start applying some of these better abilities, some a little bit more science, to whereas we can get rid of some of that old hat intrinsic knowledge where we can start enhancing moving forward. So I don't necessarily think that, maybe I use the word culling the herd, is a bad thing from time to time, because sometimes it's nice to start fresh and start with a bitter head rather than you have these program managers that inherit like a total shit sandwich and they're like, well, now what? Like, you're just kind of stuck with it. So Michelle will say I'm the eternal optimist, so I will probably find a good thing in any bad thing. So
no, I definitely can relate to that.
This episode of the Working Dog Depot podcast is brought to you by our title sponsor, Fox & Hound. Fox & Hound has spent years creating the perfect formulas that are safe for our pups and contain many natural ingredients. They develop the highest quality of products for all dogs and products for all dog lovers and their homes. Products range from scented candles to dog shampoo, flea and tick spray, stain remover, paw balm, and dog cologne. They've even developed a line for working dogs and their handlers. For you folks who are required to wear a vest while on duty, you should check out their vest spray. Folks, the Young Home has Fox & Hound products in every room. For me, it's really quite simple. The products are great, and they're made by great people. Order online at shopfoxandhound.com or follow an order on Instagram at shopfoxandhound. For a 15% discount, use the WDDP discount code. Remember, man's best friend deserves dog's best products.
I would like to think that we are two progressive older trainers.
I like it, Hoyo.
Well, how did I have one thing in common that we've been lifelong learners. We haven't rested on, you know, past knowledge because, you know, when we started, it was one way, obviously. Mm-hmm. But we've adapted and moved forward and found new ways to train and talking, you know, this podcast in itself allows us to talk to people that are doing things differently. Sometimes I don't always agree with what they're doing, but I have an open mind enough to know that there's not one way and there's no absolutes in the canine industry. And when you start talking about there's only one way to do something, that you kind of set yourself up for failure.
I agree. And realistically, I think that Michelle would probably agree with me. Our biggest successes have come from our biggest failures.
Yes.
Absolutely. You can't be afraid to fail. And actually, it reminds me that Jenna and I just started creating a list when we were at one of our last test and evaluations. Do you remember that, Jenna?
In the car?
The list of what makes a good handler?
Yep. Mm.
I'm interested already.
Yeah. So
this was totally like after a hard, long day, and we were sitting there and we said, you know what, starting off these exercises, we not only do we ask ourselves, like, what is our output? What is our ultimate goal at the end of this week? And one of the ultimate goals is making these handlers better handlers, but we ourselves have to identify what makes those handlers better handlers. And we also have to be able to purvey that to those handlers. And we're talking, you know, E4s all the way up to E7s, E8s, and sometimes, you know, even warrant officers that are rolling through. So be patient with this and also know that we were probably in a slumber on the ride home.
Or hungover. Right. So we started off the list, just like Jenna's saying, you need metrics of success. And people can walk away feeling like they're better handlers. And that's great. But what does that mean if we try and quantify it or survey them or what have you? So we started making a list, by no means inclusive, right, of all of the different things that can make someone a good handler. But I think we've already touched on a couple of them. And so one of the things is that they ask questions. And I think we see often some of the bravest, what I would consider some of the bravest people in the world, the most capable people in the world. And when they're in a group setting and someone asks, is there any questions? Not a word. No one says one thing. And it's like we are brave physically, but we don't want to be emotionally vulnerable. And so no one will stick their hand up or their neck out to say, like, I have no idea what you guys just said. Or I thought it was this way. And, you know, maybe people will laugh at me, but that's okay. Like, I don't answer to those people. I'm trying to, you know, increase my knowledge base. So I think they have to be afraid or not afraid to ask those questions and you know, sort of be vulnerable in that regard. They understand the why behind what they're doing. And so that was the next one. We see a lot, just like we said, why are you doing this that way? Oh, that's the way it's always been done, or that's the way I was taught. And those are perfectly acceptable answers. It's just maybe, you know, that's not a growth mindset necessarily that's going to allow you to become a better handler. If you're not really questioning, like, why do I do it that way? Or is there a better way? Or maybe this way's completely great. But yeah, they would sort of have that level of introspection. Good handlers are able to give feedback and take constructive criticism. So we don't do any of this work in a vacuum for the most part. We work with other canine teams in our departments and our organizations, our agencies, et cetera. And I think we all have a responsibility to each other and to our dog to be able to give feedback to someone in a really non-confrontational, but a way that is critical enough that you're giving them something actionable or something that they can reflect on, and knowing that, or at least trying to assume that they're coming from a good place in doing it, right? That they really are invested in the safety and security and success of your dog team. And so we, you know, I think that's one of the things we were trying to really instill in some of the handlers we were working with, because I don't know, people, I think most feedback is viewed as an attack, or constructive criticism is viewed as an attack. And you can choose to see it that way, but you can also choose to see if there's any validity to it and explore it and probe it and sort of take what you will of that. Good handlers do not equate knowledge with experience. So just because someone is older than you, or oh, blah, 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 I have 30 years under my belt, or I've trained more dogs than you'll ever see in your life, or whatever it is, that's great experience. It doesn't mean that they're the most knowledgeable in either whatever they're telling you or whatever they purport to be an expert in. So we've seen a lot of that. And certainly, you know, there's a lot of people that claim to be experts in things. And we try and make sure that we don't consider ourselves an expert in anything, so that we don't make that confounder. Good handlers have a good rapport with their dog. So as much as we would like to view our dogs as detection technologies or sensors, that's true, but they're also a dog, and you need to know that, you know, living being, you need to understand that what motivates that living being, and they will work for you in a more enthusiastic manner. And it just overall improves team performance. A good handler understands that good frustration builds good motivation out of their dog. So oftentimes when the dog is struggling with something, we want to jump in and fix it for them or solve it for them. And or like we want the sort of the search or the problem to be over quickly for some reason. Mm-hmm. And if you see your dog getting, or, you know, not sort of getting the answer right or struggling, sometimes I think we intervene too quickly. And we have to realize that self-discovery process of the dog that's the magic of when the dog figures it out on their own and is not working or, you know, cueing off of the handler. They're sort of getting through the problem themselves by sort of that magic again of figuring it out themselves instead of pulling the answer.
Isn't that the end game anyway? We don't want the dog. We don't want to be a part of the equation for the dog, especially an odor, right?
Right. But it's so interesting, right? Like everything is this fine line, because it's like, okay, you're supposed to have a good rapport with the dog, but you're also supposed to not be in its way and insert yourself too much into it. So it's everything, I feel like, is that fine line. And sometimes handlers get... So Jenna, what was the piece of advice that the handler got that I was just like, that is not helpful at all?
Not to get excited?
No, that was definitely not a good piece of advice. I think it was about, you don't like, just a comment, like you don't have good rapport with your dog.
Oh, the dog doesn't respect you.
Oh, the dog doesn't respect you. That's what it was. And I was like, what the hell does that mean? Like, and I understand what I think that person meant in that comment, but what does it mean to the handler? Like, so, okay, thank you for that. How can I have my dog respect me? Or what does that look like? Or what am I doing that is undermining the respect, right?
Or what haven't I done to build that rapport to begin with?
Right.
Because that's exactly usually what happens, you know, early on for us with looking at, you know, new handlers, or even, like you said, even handlers that have been handlers for years. They get their next dog and that dog is completely checked out and it's running the show and pulling them everywhere. And, you know, it's trying to self-satisfy and everything. Doesn't take any direction. And now your search that could have been over in 20 minutes just took an hour, and the dog's completely spent because he ran around like a fool versus working any type of pattern or taking direction.
Right.
But also, yeah, I think what that leads to, Michelle, is that individual gave that handler a comment without an actionable outcome. So yeah. Instead of saying, hey, your dog is looking to you for help with XYZ, or you need to do XYZ, it's just your dog doesn't respect you. Like, okay, how do I help that handler grow?
Right.
Rather than suggesting that the dog is looking for some direction from you. I mean, yes. That's a very different comment. Yeah.
So that would, and that lends to what Michelle was saying earlier, as a handler, instead of saying, hey, I don't quite understand what you're trying to tell me I need to do differently, and speaking up and being an advocate for your dog and yourself, just being like, okay, and moving on. So not only now do you have a negative thought process moving forward, we all know that goes right down the lead, but now that handler can't grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, he's probably going to make some more moves that are not going to work out in his favor, because he's going to be much more intrusive in the dog's life and
so
heavy-handed. Who knows?
Yeah. So that's actually what I thought. So when I asked the person what they meant by that comment, I said, "Do you just mean that handler needs to be more heavy-handed, like more strict with that dog?" And he's like, "No, not at all." And I was like, "Oh, then what did you mean?"
What it sounds like.
Yeah, I know. That's what I thought too. And he said, No. I just think they need to go on vacation for 2 weeks and just be a person and a dog. Like, you're not working, you're not doing, you know, detection problems. You're just being a person and a dog and spending time together. And I was like, wow, okay, that's not at all what I thought that meant. But the clarification was helpful. And I said, okay, that's great. Now tell that handler, because I don't think if she didn't, and this is what I was saying earlier, like if you have a question, there's a very high probability that someone else in the audience also has that question.
For sure.
Right. Or there's a point of confusion there. And so it's helpful for everyone when we have asked those questions and have those conversations. But Jenna actually mentioned during her last comment was that be an advocate for your dog. And so that was one of the other points that we came up with of what makes a good handler. And it really is advocating for your dog, because at some point you should be the one that knows your dog best. And we all know that they depend on us for quite a bit, and that we need to make sure that we're keeping them safe and not putting them in situations that they're not ready for. And that we, you know, on the other side are getting them ready for anything and everything. So advocate for your dog is a big one. I think we had that as the last one, but that might be right up there as the first one. These are not in rank order.
If you're going to rank them, you should put that on top.
Yeah, I think so, right? I think so. It sounds like a good one. A good handler knows their dog's tells. And so, and I remember being so frustrated by this when I was going through handler school, was that everyone's like, can't you see that? Like, can't you see that your dog is, you know, always does this when they fall, or always does this when they're on odor? And I was like, no, I can't see it, because I'm 6 feet away from the dog at the most. I'm, you know, fumbling through the leash. I'm just trying to like keep moving because my dog moves so much faster than I do. And I have a million other things in my head. So no, I don't see that. And so then through videotape, oh, there it is. Mm-hmm. Or through people being open and willing to give me feedback. Like, so Jenna gives zero fucks about giving feedback, right? As we can tell, she's very open and honest about that. So she'll tell me, hey, dummy, like, how did you not just see that? And I was like, oh, okay, thank you. Like, or that makes a lot of sense. Or yeah, I did notice that. So, you know, that is super helpful to have other people point out your dog's tells if they're willing to do that. So yeah, good handlers have an open mindset, you know, open and growth mindset. They're not afraid to fail. So that's a big one. I think we try and get all the problems right, and that's just really not realistic. It comes across in how, quote unquote, easy I think a lot of us train. I'm like, oh, let me put this training aid right in this top drawer. And, you know, like that's realistic at all, right? Instead of like, oh, I'm going to bury this training aid, you know, 3 feet deep, and we'll just see what happens, right?
Well, let's tease that out a little bit, because you bring up a good point. So when the Terriers come rolling in with whatever their build is going to be, are they going to have a quarter pound? Like everyone says, well, how do I make it smell like a quarter pound? I can only train to a quarter pound. I only want a quarter pound. Well, who told you that that's what the Terriers are rolling around with? Because last I heard, it's going to be concealed and confined, which means that you're not getting a quarter pound of odor. So Michelle, you're totally right. You're creating a robot that's always going to look for drawers, that's always going to look for that quarter pound, or that's always going to look for that same person that is the only person that can touch your explosives. And so it's true. Like, and that goes back to being an advocate for your dog, because your dog can't talk. So you have to create these scenarios that are going to push him. And like you were saying, Michelle, like that change is good change. And we can't have success without failure. And you need your dog to fail a few times. And then all of a sudden that light bulb's going to pop. And we see it in our T&Es. We have people that say, my dog can't find anything less than a quarter pound. Well, hold my beer, because I'm about to put some micrograms out there and your dog's going to freaking nail it and you're going to be mind blown. And so we have to create those scenarios for our dog to grow. Otherwise, we're just buying a dog or we're getting through school and we get this dog and go, well, that's it. That's the end of the line. That's all he's going to be able to do. But we have a biological sensor that can learn and is learning from us. But if we don't push that envelope, then yeah, that sensor's going to be stagnant. So we do. And that goes back to that whole being an advocate. You want your dog to grow, you've got to push for it.
Right. Yeah. You touched on something that's interesting. At least I think it's interesting. Cameron has been here a couple times for seminars. And the last one, we did something kind of cool. And because there were a significant number of dogs in this group that I work with, and I'm typically the one that puts out the aids. And so what we did is that we took in a couple of the rooms, I walked around and I had not handled any narcotics at all. And I had touched various places in various rooms. And it was pretty evident, if you were looking for it, the dogs that are accustomed to training with me, when they were in the room, they didn't give a false indication, but they showed a lot of interest in the places that I touched. Whereas the dogs that I did not work with, it was just irrelevant to them.
You gave them a big neon sign. Look here, dummy.
Yep. And that was an eye opener for me because I hadn't really thought about that.
That's, you know, it's the same thing we did when we started introducing buried hides, that we would dig false holes as well. So dogs weren't alerting on ground disturbance alone, you know, still get obedient to that odor. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Variables, right? Variability in training, the spice of life in all dog training, right? Variables.
Yeah, it's all part of that scent picture. So HOEO is part of the picture. Disturbed ground's part of the picture. It all is. And so that's why mixing it up and thinking outside the box is always really helpful. And it's also very probably likely that all of your training needs are contaminated with your human scent. So there's that. But that's another topic for another day.
I was going to say, wow, you were pretty kind of, it's very likely your training aids. No, your training aids are contaminated with your human stink.
They absolutely are.
Without a doubt. Whether you're using gloves or not.
Agreed.
What do you say? Glove up your meat hammers?
Double bag your meat hammers. put nitrile gloves on first, and then the polyethylene sort of what we call lunch lady gloves top of that.
That will actually keep your human scent off all of your odor. That's a great, yeah. If you're doing that, just stop doing it. You're shedding all over your odor anyway, so just stop doing it.
Tarp your load.
Tarp your load. That's not where I was going with that, Rich, but again, a subject for another day.
Yeah, I got you.
Okay, so, good handlers know how and when to motivate or calm their dog. And so some dogs are like, they just need to settle down before they go on a search. Like, you're not supposed to be doing a whole bunch of like play drive stuff and all this other stuff, because that is going to be a huge distraction when they need to just be clear headed and follow their nose. And then there's other times when the dogs are sort of, checked out, or I don't know, they're just not feeling it that day. And you need to know how to be the fluffer for your dog. So each side of that equation is necessary to be skilled in.
Oh, reading your dog.
Yeah. Another one is genuinely loves dogs and canine. Hmm. So we do see people that, I don't know how they got into canine, but they don't really love it. Mm-hmm. And I think for the type of work that we do, and that it's so interactive and it's really, you have to give a lot of yourself to that animal, that if you don't love it and it's sort of just a job, then it doesn't lead to being the best handler, I don't think. And I think most of the handlers that have been put in canine that didn't want to be there would agree to that.
Hey guys, I need to let you all know that the Thin Blue Line Conference is now the Hold the Line Canine Conference. It's the same great annual conference run by the same great folks. The Hold the Line Canine Conference is a 3-day educational conference started by Joe Lukowski, who is an active canine handler with the Pocono Mountain Regional Police Department.
It was started solely for law enforcement officers and military personnel. This year, it will be held on May 2nd through the 4th in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. They offer a variety of classes with an impressive instructor lineup, as well as an array of top-notch vendors. To ensure their attendees are up to date with the ins and outs of the canine industry, they are constantly making sure their class schedule reflects this. Some new instructors this year include Kenny Williams with Interdiction, Mike Nesbeth, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Lilly, and Steve White, to name a few. Attendee and vendor registration is now open, as well as a variety of sponsorship opportunities. Don't miss out on this amazing opportunity to have a great time with fellow brothers and sisters in blue, as well as to further educate yourself to keep you and your canine safe. Register at thinbluelineconference.com or htlk9.com. Also, follow them on Facebook and Instagram for continuous conference updates.
A good handler stays out of their dog's way. So, you know, once the dog knows what to do, really just get out of its way, because it's more likely than not that you'll be a hindrance to the dog's process.
And, you know, I think that's something that is changing. I'd like to think it's changing. It's the very old school, and obviously Rich and I have been around long enough to see old school training is the old walk backwards, block your dog, keep his nose where you want it to be in order to be effective. And it's so frustrating to watch, and it's just dead.
Or it's like it has its place, maybe at the beginning when you're trying to say, okay, dog, I want your nose here because this is productive. If they're doing a completely new type of search, right? I mean, we noticed that with our scent wheels, that dogs that have never used scent wheels before, we need to sort of show them, like, this is the productive area. Because otherwise they're looking all over everywhere else in the warehouse. And so, yeah, do that. But then once the dog understands, oh, I need to put my nose here, get out of its way. Because, yeah, that blocking, that all this other stuff, it's just, like, the dogs are moving so much faster than we are. Even when you have a slow, methodical dog, it's still processing all that information far quicker than we do. Okay, good handler. And I think this is the last one. Again, in no particular order. It starts the troubleshooting process by looking at themselves first, then the scenario, and lastly, the dog.
Say that again.
So they start the troubleshooting process. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not finding an odor, or, you know, so whatever it is. And they start that process by looking at themselves first. Mm. So be self-critical first. Mm-hmm. Then check out the scenario, like maybe it's truly there's no available odor or what else, you know, whatever else is going on. Or maybe the thing that you thought your dog falsed on actually does have a similar odor to the training aid. And then lastly, look at the dog, because it's usually not the dog's fault. And I'll say that with the caveat that we don't, if a dog is failing to recognize an odor, I start asking the question, well, what odors did we give it to begin with? Like, what are this dog's training aids? And are these dog's training aids appropriate for the things we're trying to find in the real world? And, you know, when was the last time, like, because we don't know the odor of the training aids. So most oftentimes we don't know the exact odor of our training aids. So I sort of go back to basics a little bit and make sure that I'm giving the dogs the tools to succeed, as opposed to, oh, that dog just doesn't know that odor, or that dog's not generalizing properly, or that dog's not discriminating enough, or whatever it is. And so that's, you know, that's on me to do, or help give the dog, you know, all these different types of odors so that they can generalize, or try and extinct some if we need them to be more discriminatory. So that's the last one, but I'm sure there's a ton other things that we could, you know, think of.
I would go out on a limb and say that I'd say a lot of handlers blame their dog first.
Well, so that's where that one came from. They're like, why isn't this dog, you know?
My dog's screwing me.
Yeah. This dog's punking me. This dog's screwing me. This dog. And I'm just like, they don't have, that's not their thing, right? Like, they may want to get rewarded, and that's fair.
They didn't wake up today with the mission of messing with.
Right. Yeah. So we do see that a lot. Or like, oh, this dog's just, and it's like, no. That may be true, but first start with, you know, what's your role in this? And if you're not giving your dog the proper tools to be successful, that's on you. Or you're not challenging your dogs enough, or you're not varying training enough, right? So, like,
well, look, Michelle, why don't you tell the story about you and Usher in the chamber? Why did you think he was punking you?
Oh, is this when you told me how he was falsing?
Yes. Because Because of your stupid ass face. He was
looking. Oh, that's right.
He was looking for you to give him the answer because you always did. And most handlers do, because they usually know where the hide is, or someone in the room knows where the hide is. And so these dogs aren't idiots. They'll scan the room to see if anyone is giving any facial expression that, oh, getting hotter. Oh, there he is. And you didn't know where the hide was. And so Usher was looking to you for support, where he needed to learn that you were not his support. You were just simply his reward dispenser.
Yes.
Pez dispenser.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah. So Jenna's like,
your name is D Spencer.
So Jenna turned me into like a World Series of Poker player, where I had a hat on, like down to here, sunglasses on. And I was like, oh, this dog isn't reading anything off of this face. It ain't happening. Like, I'm stoic. I'm removed. And so I did that. And then she's like, also, you need to keep moving, because once you stop, your dog thinks that that's, you know, the proper place. So I learned a ton from that. But now in a lot of our tests and evaluations, our T&Es, we see dogs looking to their handler the entire time. A lot of handler dependency. And I've kicked handlers out. I'm like, okay, leave the room. Go around the corner, because your dog's not using its nose at all in this scenario. And so they'll go out. And then I'll, you know, click when the dog gets the answer right, which inevitably they do. And then the dog will run out, you know, outside to their handler to get the reward. But the handler's facial expression, body movement, all that wasn't part of that equation. And so once we start doing that with, you know, again, scenario dependent, canine team dependent, those dogs became super independent. And those handlers felt so much more confident that, you know, sort of like in the whole search dynamic. And so we had teams from at the beginning of a week that wouldn't let their dog off lead at all. They were like, no, absolutely not. Like, my dog needs to be on lead, all this other stuff. And then by the end of the week, the dog's searching, you know, one wheel, next, going down the line all by themselves.
And I think the converse of that is true, too. I see handlers that are very quick to want to get their dog off lead because they know that dog works much better when they're not attached to the end of that lead.
I'm one of those. Because I'm slow, I'm old and slow, and I have a crappy back and a bad sciatic nerve. So I'm just like, you know,
let's not go down your medical history.
Yeah, this is too long of a list. So I'm trying to see if I have my arthritis gloves here, Jenna.
Those are the best.
Here they are.
So, but two big takeaways from just that small experience with you and Usher was, one, that we have successes from our failures. So you were failing because you were failing him as a handler.
Yeah.
And then also to learn from those mistakes and take that constructive criticism. So you were told that you were telling your dog where it was every time. So he became extremely dependent on you, and you were willing to take that leap and remove yourself from that scenario to allow him to work it without your hand in on the problem. And even bigger takeaway on this is, have someone else set up your scenarios blind, go in blind. If you are going to rely on that animal, especially explosives detector dogs, where you are relying on them with your life, and quite frankly, all those other folks behind you, have someone else set it up for you, and have different people set it up all the time. Go and train with other agencies, train on other training aids, because we're just doing ourselves a disservice by doing the same thing over and over. Because let's face it, when those dogs get on mission, it's something they have never seen before at all.
Yeah. And the context, right? That context is so different. And so the more context that your dog's working in, like different environments, scenarios, training aids, et cetera, the better that dog will be.
So going back to your list, you had to be willing to take that constructive criticism and do something positive with it also.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that I like about scientists, is that we fail so often. Like, the success rate of, so you'll try an experiment 100 times, it might work once, maybe twice, and then you're like, oh, I finally understand now what it takes to get this to work. But you have to have the personality to be able to handle such a high failure rate. And in basic research, the failure rate's very high. I honestly didn't have the emotional strength or what have you, the mental fortitude, if you will, to deal with that high of a failure rate. So I went more into applied research. And that, so in basic research, people think like they did all the hard work and figured that stuff out, so then I could start applying that two different training methodologies or concepts or different types of canine equipment, what have you. So the applied research realm has a much higher success rate, and that's where I like to sort of play in.
No, I said, that's very cool. I never took the two apart like that. You know, the guy that did all the experiments and only got it to work a couple of times, and okay, this is how it works. Now we're going to give it to you. And you,
right. But, right. Thank you. I'm like, great. Thank you. Like, I'll take that and run with it. I'm not going to be the one to discover, you know, that something new like that. And I applaud the people that do it, because we rely on, you know, their perseverance every day.
Yeah. And going back to your list, I was thinking, I really like the asking the question why and wanting to understand the why, because quick little story, we inherited a police dog that was a really kind of a badass. And Lisa, he was going to be living in our home, and she wanted to gain some better understanding of how to manage him, work him, see what working dogs are like. Though she has way more experience through just living with me, you know, over the years. But she started attending some of our trainings, and not she wouldn't stay the whole time, but she would overhear conversation, and she would kind of interject, and she would ask why, and the look on the other guy's faces are like, what are you doing? We don't ever ask why. We just do what he says, which was an eye-opener for me, because I have to, you know, it's not like my style is not one of, this is the way it's done, dictator, but I think that there was a compliance on their part to just kind of take things as they were given and roll with it. And she wants to understand, and she's not afraid to ask. And, you know, I love her for that, but it was a real eye opener. So I look for and welcome the opportunities now. You know, I found myself being a little frustrated at first, kind of like, what? You're asking me why? I think I have to explain this now.
No, but it's huge, right? So, and that's actually why it helps to have outsiders come in every once in a while, right? Because they will ask those very basic questions, like, well, why? Why do you do it that way? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it's like, oh, crap, I don't know. Or like, I thought I did it for this reason.
Well, it makes you better.
It does make you better.
It does. But yeah, well, we're missing in working with non-canine people on some of the fundamental aspects of the science behind odor or odor movement, or, you know, all sorts of various things that, like, we're working with atmospheric scientists or, you know, fluid dynamic engineers, like brilliant people, but know nothing about canine. And so I have to work to explain, you know, why we're doing this to them. And then they have to sort of work to understand, like, why the hell would you guys do it this way? And then at some point get to some sort of common understanding so that, you know, we can put out the information in a way that is publishable in the academic realm, so it's technical enough for that. And then also digestible in a classroom setting at a canine conference. Mm-hmm. So it has to span that whole realm, or else it doesn't, we don't feel like we're doing a proper job by the science if we don't communicate it out.
Well, the science will never come down to the field.
Right.
You know, a handler, you know, a police officer, just like I was 20 years ago, handling a dog, that would have been way over my head.
Right.
And if you can't make it palatable, then it won't ever make it where it needs to be.
Yeah. So yeah, Nathan Hall's been doing a great job of that. Out of Texas Tech. And I said, Nathan, like, I love your infographic. He's like, thank you. Because it takes him, like, that's not what he needs to be spending his time doing, but he's doing it because that's an easily digestible form of 2 years of his work and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages of documentation and manuscripts and whatnot. But he makes it into a form that anyone can look at and say, oh, I get that take home message. And if I want to find out more, I can go to, you know, the primary literature. So we try and break things down as much as possible into some sort of, yeah, infographic, flow chart, what have you, so that information makes its way out of academia and into the field.
So I want to ask this question. In your dealings with folks outside of this industry, well, I hear it all the time. People say it's the dog world. The dog world is so divisive. It's so this, it's so that. And, you know, I have done lots of things in my life, and I don't know that it's any more divisive. I think there are a lot of strong opinions based on personal experiences that people just, you know, they stick to them. That, but I don't know that it's made of people, and people have opinions, and it just seems that there are so many opinions in this industry. Do you see in other areas that you work in that there's that, I don't even want to call it divisiveness, but that, what would you say? It's grasping on to things you believe and hold to be true. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I think there's less arguing about facts and opinions, not opinions, but facts in the scientific world, I think. Like, most people are, part of being a scientist is having an open mindset.
Yes.
And
being willing to fail.
Right.
Gotcha.
So there's a lot less of that. However, there's still ego and agenda.
Uh-huh.
And so those two will cloud and destroy any collaboration. They will make it so that, yeah, there can be divisiveness, or just, you know, a lack of working together for the better of whatever project you're on or the industry that you work in or what have you.
Michelle, add it to the list. Being a good handler is being willing to collaborate.
Boom.
That is a good one.
Here at Working Dog Depot, we're pleased to make an extra special announcement. Fox and Hound Canine Foundation will be hosting their first celebration event with a fun-filled day meeting canine teams from across the country in an incredible atmosphere on Table Rock Lake in Branson, Missouri. On June 3rd, fun for the whole family will start at 12 noon. Included in the day of events are special canine demonstrations, raffles, a silent auction, vendor booths, balloon artists, live entertainment, and music. Later on in the evening, you're invited and encouraged to join in the gala event starting at 6. You can purchase an entire table or individual seating as you see fit. Enjoy an open bar, which will transition into a cash bar a little bit later in the evening. Also included are a silent auction, music, special private canine demonstrations, and VIP guest appearances. A detailed agenda will be forthcoming as the event date draws closer. We know that the folks at Fox and Hound, our title sponsor, have a huge heart for canines and their handlers. It's important to know that all proceeds that are raised by their fantastic Canine Foundation event go to assist canine teams by providing funding, equipment, supplies, paid canine medical expenses, canine handler education, and specialty training for active and retired canines. Don't miss out on this super opportunity to network, have some fun, and support a wonderful cause. We hope to see you there.
So, yeah, so we, and then also like politics, right?
Mm.
And, you know, maybe that's agenda, part of that's agenda, but I think there's very much in canine, I find that it's like who you align yourself with.
Right.
It makes a big difference. And sometimes if you play well with everyone, that's kind of viewed as a negative too. Like, how could you play with that person?
I get that completely. Cause that, I think you just described me.
So that's another one, right? We talked about that. Like, who is the keeper of the professionalism and the standards that we want to hold ourselves to as an industry?
Right.
And, you know, I think you were nominated as one of the people, Ho-Yo. And I can completely see why, because you're used to dealing in the human psychological realm. But yeah, it's sometimes if you play well with everyone, that's also a negative. And then, so I get that.
Well, I think navigating those waters is that you have to, there's a time to take a stand, and then there's plenty of times where you just don't pick up the rope, right? Because you can't play tug of war with someone if you don't pick up the rope. So, and I think that's the tricky part in all of this.
Yes. So
did you hear that, Michelle?
Jennifer tells me this all the time. She's like, "Stay off Facebook, you idiot!" And I'm like, "Fine." But yeah, I mean, there's definitely like taking the bait, you know, knowing which battle to fight and which one not to, what's worth your time. And then there's other times when you see. Like, you see really, truly awful, you know, behavior, and you do need to take a stand. And right. And that's a personal call based on, like, your ethics, your morals, all that stuff. But, and I think people are redeemable, too. So your points, like, your relationship with that person or that set of ethics can change. And that's okay, too, because if people, you know, really come to the table and make amends, then I think we have to honor that, too.
Right.
It's just, yeah, there's, so the way I describe canine is tribal.
Mm.
it feels very tribal. And it's what tribe are you a part of? And sort of have to know how to navigate that answer. And so it's like maybe sometimes the answer is no tribe, right?
Right.
Not picking up that rope. Mm-hmm. And I asked someone recently, like, hey, what do you think about this person's, you know, tracking or trailing and all that? And they were like, I don't think anything about it. I was like, yeah, right. What do you mean you don't think? And I wasn't baiting the person. Like, I legitimately, because tracking's not something that I know a lot about. And so I was legitimately curious. And I wasn't baiting him, but he refused to even like take the bait, right?
Right.
That he was like, I don't think about it. I was like, you have to have some thoughts. And he's like, no, he's like, all I care about is what I do.
Right.
And I was like, this is either very mature, very arrogant, or no, like I was trying to figure out what this was because it was so different than what I'm used to when I ask, like, hey, what do you think about this? You know, and people have just like a litany of opinions, right? Like, I hate it or I love it, or you know, something strong, some sort of strong feeling.
Yeah, I kind of feel like at this stage there are things that I feel that work well for me, but I also am hopeful that there is something else out there. So I'm willing to look to see if somebody has discovered something new under the sun, even though they probably haven't and they've just dressed it up differently. So,
but even that's interesting, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, so a lot of this is it's people that. This is their living, right? They're making a business out of what they're doing. And maybe they're marketing it better than you are or I am or what have you. And so there's something to learn from that. Like even when someone is not correct or doesn't have the best way or whatever, if mm-hmm. maybe I can learn something from how confident they speak about it.
Well, there are some folks out there like that.
Yeah, that cool. Like, okay, well, you know, everyone's believing this person. Why? Or they're like better at social media than you are, you know? Mm. So it was funny. I did, you know, ChatGPT, like that artificial intelligence enhanced chat. So Google launched their BARD. It's called BARD, BARD experiment. And same type of thing. But you can ask it questions. And so I asked it who the best dog trainer in the U.S. is.
Oh, wow.
Are you guys ready for this?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's lucky that it said what it said, because it started off with, there is no one best dog trainer in the United States, as different trainers have different specialties and approaches to training. However, some of the most well-known and respected dog trainers in the U.S. include Victoria Stilwell, Kiko Pup, I don't know who that is, Zach George, we know that name from recent Facebook stories. Jean Donaldson, I guess, she wrote books called Culture Clash and Inside of a Dog. And then Tina Smith, she wrote the book, The Reactive Dog. So I don't know. I just thought it was interesting that like wherever that AI sort of, you know, crawled the web and figured out that was an appropriate answer.
Sounds a little bit like a popularity contest.
Yeah. So, right. So, it does say most well-known.
Right.
And so it's
right.
Like, okay, well, what do those people have in common? What are they doing well? Are they publishing a lot? Are they social, like very active on social media? Do they have their own television show? You know, not all those things may be accessible. I don't have to agree with this thing at all, but you know, it's just interesting to get some sort of, I guess, like objective data back from this AI that is trying to figure out who the best dog trainer in the country is. Mm-mm-mm. So I'm sorry that Hoya wasn't on there.
No, I didn't expect to be.
Well, you know, what you guys probably don't know about Hoyo is that, you know, he's very much a prima donna.
I get that from him. He always is talking about his like special beard oils.
Yes.
And just like all of the grooming he has to do to maintain that handsome profile.
Goodness gracious.
But so he's got to. I mean, he's got a dime piece of a wife. So he's, you know, he's got to keep that.
Every man deserves to get lucky at least once.
Agreed.
Quick overview of what you're going to be speaking about in Pittsburgh. Can you do that without spoiling anything?
Yeah, Johnny, you want to take it?
Nerds are a threat to the way of life.
Absolutely. I know two that are.
Because we will challenge you to be self-critical, to be an advocate for your dog, and to take that constructive criticism and absolutely apply it. And not to mention, we're going to bring a lot of lessons to the lab because, let's face it, Michelle and I fail more than we are successful.
Any hope of liquid refreshment this time?
That's a guarantee.
All right.
Do bear I'll shit in the woods? The correct answer is no, ho-yo. Polar bears don't.
Yeah, we will definitely have libations. And
I feel like that's the only way people can handle us, really.
Well, you know
that's the only way I
probably should take something away from that. We don't have the sexiest of topic. So there's going to be some real lively options. And, you know, I don't know if we can speak for 4 hours. I mean, for 2 hours to four people.
Well, but honestly, that's what Michelle and I were saying is who the hell wants to come listen to scientists? Like, that's pretty damn boring. So we kind of have to, we'll bring glitter. So we had to bring the full razzle dazzle and kind of make it seem like it was going to be way more fun.
Yeah.
And that's also on us to also make science fun too, because it can be really boring and really monotonous. And then we're just like, you know, cramming stuff down your hole where it's like, I really don't care what you're saying.
But we will bait and switch the hell out of you guys. So.
Oh, we're pretty good at bait and switch.
We're gonna pull you in with that free beer and the razzle dazzle and then hit you with some science over the head. And we'll try and make it as painless as possible.
Sounds
but like I'm glad to hear that the beer was a winning ticket for you, Ho-Yo.
Oh, it was ingenious. Yeah, it was great.
Brilliant.
Most people thought we were lying.
Pardon me? They were like, no way.
we ought to hand out a bottle of bourbon, Rich.
Ooh. Do something. That's going to be a...
You should do like a campside, like campfire chat with Ho-Yo and Rich. Cigars and whiskey.
That would be awesome.
Oh.
Yeah, you're bourbon, beers, and brains. Right? That's ours next year, Michelle.
Yeah. You're a big cigar guy, right? Ho-Yo?
I do like cigars, yes.
Yeah. All right, so roll up with some Cubans and make it happen.
That sounds good. Well, it's less than 10 days away, ladies, so.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
Hold on to your butts.
I appreciate you guys taking the time to chat with us. I think it's been very good, very good episode.
If we do say so.
Were you worried?
No, not really.
Well, you're not as good as Howard Stern is as an interviewer, but I will give you, I think you may be the Howard Stern of the canine podcast world.
Oh my gosh, I don't think I want that moniker at all.
With your smooth nighttime DJ voice.
Yes.
All right, ladies. I'm gonna stop recording because you're killing me. All right. Thanks again.
All right, tonight's bourbon of choice is the Henry McKenna 10-year. Single.
Yes, indeed it is.
Single barrel.
I got my first bottle the other day. I scored this bottle, Henry McKenna, and I also got another Booker's, which I have got one waiting in reserve. So it was a good day.
Absolutely. Well, those are both good choices. This is a Heaven Hill product.
Mm-hmm. I will say, I think I may have found a new favorite.
It's pretty tasty. It's got a great.
I really like it.
All right. Well, here's the hair dog, the bitch.
Thank you very much. See you shortly.
Yeah, 10 days, right?
Woo. Yep.
All right, my friend.
Thanks so much, you guys, for following along, supporting us, and listening to these wonderful conversations that Howard and I are just blessed to have each and every day. We'd like to thank and support all of our first responders, police, fire, EMS, and our military for once again holding the line, keeping us safe. Stay safe, brothers and sisters. We love you. God bless, and God bless America.